Cave, Bio 241. We have an announcement from your SI leader right now before class.
We're doing the practice exam on Tuesday, and then on Thursday is your exam. So we'll do figures like normal, or study session. I just recommend you come even if you don't want to participate. It's good to be here. So, like I said, that's what I usually do.
Okay, yes, we don't want you on the edge. Okay, so let's look at the schedule here on the right-hand slide. So we're in respiratory. We're going to finish that up today, maybe get into renal physiology today, maybe, maybe not. But anyway, let's see, today is a Thursday, right? Indeed it is, which means a week from today is your last exam. Right? So we call it a final exam, but it's not really a final exam. You still have only an hour and a half or whatever it is to take it, 100 questions on the test. It's just a usual test, right? It's not cumulative. But what is on the test? Chapter 13 is going to be on the test, 14, 16, and 17, and that all-important figure in Chapter 20, which shows the hormone profiles with the ovarian and uterine cycles. Yeah.
In percentages, how much of your time from here on out would you dedicate to studying Chapter
7 renal physiology? I don't know. The figures are really good to know.
The figures are really
absolutely
good. So, like, I think the practice quizzes, There are no, specific, it says review it, etc.
Yeah.
However, there are no,
Okay, well, if you have time to look over those things, I would maybe look over those questions maybe once or twice, but I wouldn't go over them 100 times.
But spend more time on figures than you would
practice.
Yeah. That
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we were in respiratory chapter. And let's see where we kind of left off, someplace around here. We talked about control of ventilation. Yeah. Okay, so does anybody have any questions so far before we press on as far as the schedule goes? Okay, let's just go to one and one, and then, we got to start the slideshow. And then we got to make sure our pointer doesn't go away. Okay. All right, so we were looking at some chemicals that can affect respiration. And basically, there are three. And what are those three chemicals in your body that affect ventilation, that can regulate, help regulate ventilation? CO2 is one. Oxygen is another. And? Hydrogen ion concentration, or pH. Right. All right, and the most sensitive is CO2. We were talking about that, and that always kind of surprised me. Because, right, CO2 directly influences the pH within your body. And we're familiar with this because if we look at carbon dioxide, it can combine with water to produce carbonic acid. And then carbonic acid can dissociate into hydrogen ion, which acidifies that solution, and bicarbonate. So you're familiar with this equation, and if you look at these arrows right here that go from one side of the equation to the other, what can you tell me about these arrows? They're bidirectional, right? They're bidirectional. So there really is no free energy change in this reaction, so that means that it can go to the right as easily as it can go to the left. But what controls? What is actually going to control how this equation behaves? Yeah, the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. All right, you guys, if you got to converse, please go out in the hallway, okay? Okay, go out in the hallway if you got something really important to say. All right, so it is Le Chatelier's principle. So, for instance, if carbon dioxide increases in this particular solution, then more will combine with water, and it will force the reaction to the right. And when that produces more carbonic acid, that's going to then produce more hydrogen ion, right? So if you increase carbon dioxide levels in this solution, what's going to happen to pH? pH will go lower. Yeah, don't forget that pH number is inversely related to the hydrogen ion concentration. As something becomes more acidic, the pH number decreases. Right. So, for instance, if somebody will hyperventilate, and we could all hyperventilate right now if we wanted to, because that diaphragm is under voluntary control. If we were to hyperventilate, we would breathe out a lot of CO2 from our body, an excess amount of CO2. Right. And so hyperventilation would cause a low carbon dioxide. We call that hypocapnia. We could cause that condition in us. And when we lose CO2, what's going to happen to this equation right here? Which way is it going to go? If we were to hyperventilate and lose CO2, it's going to move to the left, right? So it's going to so bicarbonate in your body is going to combine with hydrogen ion, and that's going to produce carbonic acid. That's going to dissociate into water and carbon dioxide. And then if you continue to hyperventilate, then you'll even excrete more of that carbon dioxide, which will what? Eat up more of this hydrogen ion in solution. All right, so as this hydrogen ion goes away in your body, what happens to your body? Does it become more acidic or more alkalotic? Yeah, it becomes more alkalotic. And hence, when you hyperventilate, or when people hyperventilate, that can produce an alkalosis in your body that we call a respiratory alkalosis. So just by breathing, you can change the pH of your body. And by breathing out, we're actually breathing out what from our body? We're breathing acid out of our body, so we're all very alien in that sense, right? We used to do some experiments where we'd measure the pH of respired air as it bubbled through a water solution, and the pH of that water solution just decreases very rapidly, right? So we expel a lot of acid from our body just by breathing. All right, so you should know the name of this enzyme that interconverts all of these products right here. And that is, you're familiar with that, what's the name of that enzyme that allows this to happen very quickly? Even though there's no free energy change, there's still activation energy barriers, and that enzyme reduces those activation energy barriers, so this reaction happens very rapidly inside your body, and that enzyme is called carbonic anhydrase. What happened? No, carbonic anhydrase. All right, so that's an important enzyme for the respiratory system. Okay, so this diagram right here, don't know if this is an exam figure, and I can't quite see on my diagram what it starts with up over there. Decreased ventilation. All right, so if you decrease ventilation, what happens to the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in your body if you decrease ventilation? Carbon dioxide increases. Right, and when carbon dioxide increases, what happens to pH? pH goes down because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Right, so blood pH decreases. There are chemoreceptors in the aortic and carotid bodies that then send signals to the respiratory center that's saying that blood pH is decreasing, it's becoming more acidic. Right, the other thing is that plasma CO2 levels increase. And that decreases the pH of interstitial fluid. And that will affect the chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata, which will then tell the respiratory center to increase the rate of ventilation. Right, so the respiratory center will send signals down that nerve to respiratory muscles, for instance, like the diaphragm. And what's the name of that nerve that goes? Everybody should know the name of that nerve that goes to the diaphragm. That's the phrenic nerve. Yeah, it's a phrenic nerve. Right, and that increases ventilation, and when you increase ventilation, that will decrease arterial PCO2, and so we see that the response subtracts from the initial stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis. All right, so that's a pretty easy response loop to understand. Okay, the brain chemoreceptors are responsible for the greatest effect on ventilation. Hydrogen ion can't cross the blood-brain barrier because it's a charged particle, but CO2 is really neither hydrophobic nor hydrophilic, and it can't pass through the membrane. And so it's monitored, and that's why it has the greatest central effects. All right, so the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted to maintain a PCO2 of about 40 millimeters of mercury. And if it increases, then that's going to increase ventilation. If it decreases, then ventilation will decrease. Right? The peripheral chemoreceptors in the aortic arch and carotid sinus don't respond to CO2 levels, only to hydrogen ion levels in the blood. Okay, so here we have the medulla oblongata, and we have CO2 in plasma. That CO2 in plasma can cross the blood-brain barrier. And remember something about that blood-brain barrier has to do with those ependymal cells, right, that surround capillaries in the brain. So it only allows certain kinds of molecules to move from the plasma into the cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so CO2 can go across the blood-brain barrier, but hydrogen ions can't. Hydrogen ions are pretty much, even though they're related to each other through the carbonic anhydrase reaction, still, you should realize that carbon dioxide is the only thing that can enter the cerebrospinal fluid. But when it does, because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction in the brain, that carbon dioxide is converted into carbonic acid and then to hydrogen ions, and then these hydrogen ions then will stimulate centers within the medulla oblongata, and that will increase ventilatory rate when that happens. Okay, so indirectly, hydrogen ions are important for regulating the central chemoreceptors. All right, so we've only talked about CO2 so far, and that's because it has the most important and most powerful effect on ventilation. But oxygen levels sometimes are monitored, especially when oxygen levels decrease a lot inside your body, right? So low blood partial pressure of oxygen, we call that hypoxemia, has little effect on ventilation unless it is reduced drastically. Okay, but a reduced partial pressure of oxygen can change the sensitivity of chemoreceptors to pCO2, makes them more sensitive. Okay, the partial pressure of oxygen has to fall to about half the normal value before ventilation is significantly increased. Okay. And so that's a huge change. Small changes in pCO2 can make major changes in ventilation, but there has to be a huge change in PO2 in order to have an effect on ventilation. Sometimes, I wouldn't say oftentimes, but I would say sometimes ventilation is stimulated by hypoxic drive rather than by CO2. Hypoxic drive might have an effect if the PO2 of your body decreases by more than half, right? And so that will greatly influence the respiratory center. And for instance, that happens, the partial pressure of oxygen will drop drastically in somebody when they stop breathing, okay? So somebody might be on a ventilator, and maybe they are mostly brain dead, maybe their cerebrum is no longer functioning, but their brainstem still might be functioning. And when they're taken off of a respirator, right, they're declared dead, and the family realizes, well, gee whiz, you know, this really would be a terrible situation to keep grandma, grandpa, or somebody on this ventilator for another 5 years when they're brain dead. So let's take them off the ventilator, right, and you come to grips with that situation. Right, but sometimes it's really terrible or really scary to be in the room when that happens. Because when somebody is taken off of a ventilator, even though their brain is dead, their oxygen levels start to decrease, and that's a very powerful stimulus to the respiratory center in the medulla to stimulate ventilation, right? And so even though somebody is brain dead and they're right in the process of passing away, they can go through these what we call agonal breathing episodes where this super decreased level of oxygen will stimulate the respiratory center and they'll take some gasps, right? And then everybody, you just have to be prepared for that. It's really scary when that happens because then you start to question, well, did we make the right decision, right? And of course you did. It's just that this person is going through some agonal breathing and it's just reflex activity. It really doesn't have much to do with conscious brain activity at all. They're not consciously controlling their respiration at all. All right, so that's related to this hypoxic drive. So let's look at a graph that kind of shows those two principles. So here we have a graph. When we measure carbon dioxide in, I guess that's maybe a red, carbon dioxide in red and oxygen in blue. And on the vertical axis, we have like a respiratory rate in terms of liters per minute. How much how much air are we breathing in and out of our bodies. And the vertical axis on the right is exactly the same on the left. It's the same scale. But the horizontal axis is different compared to whether we're going to be looking at carbon dioxide or oxygen. All right, so on the bottom axis, we see what? A decrease as we move from left to right of oxygen, percent oxygen, it decreases. But if we look at CO2 on the top of the curve, if we go from left to right, right, we're going to see what? An increase in CO2. All right, so these things are related in the right sense. They're reversed on these scales so that they do make the correct sense to us when we look at it. Okay, so if we look at this oxygen, when we vary oxygen, normal conditions, okay, we were maybe about 18% oxygen, but it has to drop to maybe half or maybe even more than half before it has a significant effect on increasing ventilatory rates, okay, or increasing ventilation. So there has to be a big change, 100% change, okay? But now let's look at the carbon dioxide level, and we need to look at this scale up over here. So instead of decreasing carbon dioxide, we need to consider what? Increasing carbon dioxide levels, right? So normally it's right about here, but as soon as we go from 4 to 5%, that's just a 20% change, all right, notice there's a huge change in ventilation, and that continues, right? So small changes in carbon dioxide make large changes in ventilation, right? But changes, large changes in oxygen almost have no effect on ventilatory rate until, okay, there are really huge changes taking place, almost until oxygen goes to almost zero. Okay, so that just kind of underscores how important carbon dioxide is. Okay, so leaving that topic and then just considering the anatomy of a lung. A lung is very delicate tissue, right? It's filled with all those alveoli and elastic fibers. And how strong is an elastic fiber? Just think of all the different fibers that a connective tissue can make. How strong is elastic fiber? What's the strongest one? Collagen, right? So collagen for sure is the strongest one. And elastic means that it is not as strong as collagen. Its only property is that it can stretch, and then when you let go, it's going to go back to its original length as long as you don't overstretch it. But elastic fibers can be overstretched, and when they're overstretched, they're damaged. All right. And remember, you have all those elastic fibers around an alveolus, so there is a reflex that protects your lungs from overfilling so that those elastic tissues aren't damaged and the alveoli aren't damaged so that you don't have microhemorrhages of all those capillaries around the alveoli. And that's called the Herring-Brewer reflex. There are stretch receptors in the lungs, and they become activated during inspiration. And the more you inspire, the more they become activated, right? And the more they're activated, the more they inhibit the respiratory centers, right? And when they inhibit the respiratory centers, that prevents overinflation of the lungs. So maybe there is a way you can consciously hurt your lungs if you try to overinhale, but that would probably take some practice to do that, because this Herring-Brewer reflex is very efficient and powerful in preventing overinflation of the lungs. All right, so that's a good reflex for you to know about. Okay, so let's now talk about how oxygen and CO2 are transported in the blood, because that's one of the functions of blood, is to transport oxygen and CO2, right? Oxygen from the air to your tissues, and then CO2 from the tissues back out into the air. And the compound that we use for transporting oxygen is called hemoglobin. And loading of hemoglobin occurs in the lungs, and oxygen leaves hemoglobin in the tissues, right? So it's a nice, like, door-to-door delivery system. And that happens because affinity of hemoglobin to oxygen changes with a couple important parameters that we're going to look at, physiologic variables. All right, so let's look at a hemoglobin molecule. Here we see that there's a pigment. I see four of these iron groups, a heme group with an iron. So here is heme. That's an organic compound. And in the very center of it is an iron, and it's in a plus 2 state, so it has an electrical charge, so it has an affinity for oxygen, right? And we've got four of these. There are four chains of hemoglobin, four chains of globin. These are protein chains, And so there are two beta chains and two alpha chains that come together. They just have the right shape, and each one of these chains has a hemoglobin. So this is a hemoglobin molecule, and could you guess how many oxygens can bind to this one molecule of hemoglobin? Yeah, it's four, right? One for every iron molecule in that hemoglobin molecule. So each hemoglobin can carry four O2s around in your body. Okay, but don't forget now, what is the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So there's just a chain of amino acids here, right, in the beta chain. Both beta chains are just sequences of amino acids in the alpha chains as well, right? And if you were to change the amino acid sequence, what else would you change? Amino acid sequence is what? The primary structure. And if you change the primary structure, what could happen? Change the secondary structure of that protein, and then the tertiary structure, and then the quaternary structure that we see right here. We're going to take a look at that in the very last slide, almost the very last slide on this chapter. Right, so don't forget your nice biochemistry that we learned earlier on. All right, so let's have a solution. Let's take plasma and put it in this chamber over here. And notice we don't have any red blood cells in this chamber, just plasma. That's what plasma means, right? It's just a fluid part of blood. Doesn't have any cells. And then if we put whole blood over here, of course, then we have the cellular or the formed elements, including red blood cells. And what do we have in red blood cells? Hemoglobin. That can bind oxygen. All right, so with these two chambers right here, we're going to bubble some oxygen through both of these chambers, and we're going to measure how much oxygen, after a short period of time, is going to be contained in these two chambers right here, with and without oxygen. All right, so we're going to bubble these tanks with 100 millimeters of partial pressure of oxygen. All right, and so if we look at the PO2 inside these chambers, it's going to be exactly what we're bubbling it with, because it's going to reach equilibrium. Right, so we got a partial pressure of oxygen of 100 in plasma and 100 in whole blood. But now let's stop that bubbling and measure how much oxygen really is in both of these containers. All right, so then we take out all of the oxygen, measure the oxygen just in plasma, and at standard temperatures and pressures, we get 0.3 mLs of oxygen for every 100 mLs of plasma. So that's not very much oxygen. Oxygen does not like to dissolve in water, and in particular plasma, because plasma is mostly made out of water. But if we look at whole blood, don't forget, we got red blood cells loaded with hemoglobin, right? And there's almost 300 million hemoglobin molecules in every red blood cell, right? So that's why a red blood cell doesn't have a nucleus. It hardly has any organelles at all, because there's no room in there. It's completely packed with hemoglobin. And remember, each hemoglobin can bind four oxygens, so four oxygens times, what, 300 million? Well, that's like, what? That's 120 million molecules of oxygen for every red blood cell. So we're going to count all of those, and we see that under standard temperatures and pressures, there's going to be 20 mLs of oxygen when we have red blood cells in it for every 100 mLs of blood. So what is that? So that is like 100 times as much compared to plasma. All right, so now we can see that the way oxygen is transported in your body, in the blood, is bound to hemoglobin. Okay. Hemoglobin can take a couple different forms. Most of it is in the +2 state. All right, but every once in a while, or even under certain circumstances normally, some of the iron is in the +3 state. So that's the oxidized form, right, because it's given away an electron. So it gave away an electron and became oxidized. So that ferric iron can't bind oxygen. So, and that kind of hemoglobin is what we call methemoglobin, as opposed to just regular old hemoglobin or oxyhemoglobin. And blood normally contains a small amount of that. Okay. There's another form of hemoglobin. For instance, if somebody is breathing carbon monoxide, all right, carbon monoxide has a very high affinity for hemoglobin, much more so than oxygen. And can you picture in your mind what carbon dioxide is? Carbon dioxide is what? A carbon and two oxygens, and carbon monoxide is what? A carbon and only one oxygen. So it's a lot different kind of compound. And carbon monoxide is a product from incomplete combustion of fuels, right? Maybe like an internal combustion engine or candles, right? Or maybe if you're using a gas stove at home, produces carbon monoxide, and it binds to hemoglobin, and it produces a compound called carboxyhemoglobin instead, right? And when CO2 binds to hemoglobin, that does not allow oxygen to bind to it, right? So that's a very particular kind of very harmful poison, right? So if you're breathing carbon monoxide, that's like not breathing at all, right? That's like having somebody with their hands around your throat where you can't even breathe. And the reason why that is so dangerous is because carbon monoxide has an affinity of 210 times stronger than oxygen, right? So when that, and when it binds, oxygen can't bind to that heme element in hemoglobin. So really the only effective treatment for this is to put somebody on a high oxygen atmosphere so that these oxygens can bounce off a carbon monoxide molecule. But in order for, okay, in order for oxygen to have an equal opportunity to bind to hemoglobin, how many times would we have to increase this oxygen molecule? 210 times. Before you get a 50-50 mixture. And then you're going to have to increase oxygen concentration even higher than that to decrease the carboxy hemoglobin in somebody's body. All right, so the other kind of dangerous thing about carbon monoxide is that it is odorless and it's colorless, so it's very hard to detect just with your normal senses. And because the affinity is so high, even very small concentrations of carbon monoxide can build up inside your body because hemoglobin binds to it. And so if you breathe small concentrations of carbon dioxide for a long period of time, that's exactly like breathing a high concentration of carbon dioxide for a short period of time. So carbon monoxide poisoning can build up over time and you don't notice it, but it is still deadly, yeah.
Blood cell dies, or would it stay within the blood system?
You know, hemoglobin is broken down when that red blood cell is lysed, and you know, after 120 days, that carbon monoxide would be cleared from somebody's body, or they would be dead. Okay, so it's really not too an important an issue. Yeah. Good question, though. But maybe, for instance, maybe carbon monoxide bound itself to a red blood cell that has lived for 119 days and it's going to die tomorrow, well, there still might be some carbon monoxide bound to it. Yeah. In which case, I don't know, you just probably have to breathe that out of your body. I'm not quite sure how to answer that question. Okay. So, we need to analyze how oxygen is transported in the blood, and so we have some numbers on this table. This is a really important table, right? So we're going to see partial pressure of oxygen compared to the percent binding of oxyhemoglobin. All right, so how much oxygen binds to hemoglobin if we change the partial pressure? And think of that as like the concentration of oxygen in plasma. And we're just going to compare arterial blood with venous blood. Right? Arterial blood has partial pressure of about 100 millimeters of mercury of oxygen, and at that partial pressure, almost all of the hemoglobin is bound to oxygen, but not quite, only 97%, but that's really close to 100%. Right, but in venous blood, the partial pressure of oxygen decreases to 40, in which case, then, only 75% of hemoglobin is bound to oxygen. So this difference right here in percent hemoglobin is the amount that has been delivered to tissues, right, as the partial pressure drops from 100 to 40. Well, when we look at tabulated data, it's not very satisfying. So what would we really like to do? We'd like to make a curve of those numbers and graph it out to take a look and see what's going on. All right, so here is a percent oxygen saturation curve. And notice as we increase the partial pressure, and you could think of that as concentration, right? As we increase the partial pressure of oxygen, what happens to binding of oxygen to hemoglobin? Does it increase or decrease? It increases, right? So it's directly related, but it's not a nice straight line. It's what we call this nice sigmoid curve right here. All right, so what did we say was the partial pressure in arteries? It was 100 millimeters of mercury. And if we plot that out, we see that almost 100% of hemoglobin is bound to oxygen, or oxygen binds almost 100%, almost saturates completely all the hemoglobin inside somebody's blood. Okay, and we see that that is about 20 mLs for every 100 mLs in blood. That's the content of oxygen, right? And then as it passes through capillaries and leaves through a vein, the partial pressure decreases because some of that oxygen leaves your blood and goes into the tissue spaces. Now we want to figure out how much oxygen actually leaves the blood to go in tissue spaces. And this curve is really nice because it will tell us. So how do we find that out? Well, let's just draw a couple vertical lines here. Let's find the points on this sigmoid curve at 40 millimeters of mercury for at the venous end compared to 100 at the arterial end of a capillary. And that difference is going to be the amount of oxygen that's delivered to a tissue. And you could look at the percent oxyhemoglobin saturation, but probably a better way to look at it is just in the total concentration of oxygen in the blood compared to the arterial end and the venous end of a capillary. This is the amount of oxygen that's delivered to the tissues, which is what? About 5 milliliters of oxygen at standard pressures and temperatures for every 100 mLs of blood. All right, so the other thing you can see with this graph is that after blood leaves this capillary, how much oxygen is left in the blood? Most of it is still left in blood, right? So here is, this is the blood going back to your heart, and it is still carrying, what, 15 mLs of oxygen for every 100 mLs of blood, or it's still, what, maybe 75% saturated? And for this reason, recently the CPR guidelines were readjusted. Okay, and does anybody know how they were readjusted? And maybe it's been a long time already. Time passes so fast for me. But anyway, how have they been readjusted in recent history? Does anybody know? Anybody CPR certified? Yeah, so what has been decreased is the amount of respirations, okay, that you perform on somebody compared to the amount of chest compressions. All right, so chest compressions move blood through their body. When you do breathing for them, that just increases the saturation of oxygen in their blood. All right. So what somebody realized was, well, you know what? Even venous blood has a lot of oxygen. What we need to do is just get that blood to their tissues, and then more oxygen will be unloaded even from that blood if it hasn't gone to the lungs for oxygenation. All right. So it's more important to help somebody with their circulatory response to get blood flowing through their circulatory system, even venous blood, because you see that it still has a lot of oxygen in it compared to spending time doing respirations on somebody. And when you're breathing for somebody, you can't do chest compressions, right? They don't go hand in hand. So now we know it's more important to do chest compressions than to breathe for somebody compared to how we were doing it previously. Okay, so you can see that on this curve. All right, well, there's some things that change when we change our activity level, and of course one thing is pH, right? So what happens to the affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin when the pH is changed in your body? And the normal pH is about 7.4, right? So we're just a little bit alkalotic, right? So that's, and we're just going to call that normal affinity, and what, that's about 20 mLs of oxygen for every 100 ml of blood. And that means, but if we just were to look at that curve once again, we would see that 5 mLs of oxygen per 100 mLs of blood was delivered to the tissues at this particular pH. Now, when you start exercising a muscle, for instance, what happens to the pH? Stay the same? Does it go up or down? It goes down, becomes, right, a little bit acidic, right? And when the blood becomes acidic, right, 7.4 to 7.2, the affinity for hemoglobin to oxygen decreases. That's really kind of fantastic, because when the affinity decreases, right, in tissues, look what happens to oxygen delivery to the, or unloading of hemoglobin. It increases. So as the blood becomes more acidic, right, more oxygen is unloaded into tissues, and when that blood goes back to the lungs will be back at a normal pH, right? And so it will load back up to almost 100% saturation, and then when that blood gets down to a tissue where it's acidic, it will release more oxygen. So that is a pretty handy circumstance. And as your blood becomes more alkalotic, okay, that increases the affinity and that reduces the oxygen delivery to tissues. Right? That's not so important typically physiologically. So let's look at that oxygen binding curve once again. And it's just the old familiar sigmoid curve that we see. And now we have three curves at three different pHs. Right? And the one in the middle is at normal pH 7.4. And which way do we have to look, right or left, to see a more acidic condition? We have to look to the right. That's really good for you to see. All right, so let's compare the 7.4 and 7.2 curves. We said this at 7.4, okay, where do we unload oxygen? Between 100 and 40. All right, so this right here, right, I'm sorry, from here to 100, that's the amount of oxygen unloading at normal pH. But in the acidic pH, what is the unloading? It is always the partial pressure of oxygen is still going to be the same, right? But now there's more unloading of oxygen in tissues at a lower pH. So you have enhanced delivery of oxygen to the tissues, right, with a decrease in pH. And you see that that pH curve is shifted to the right, right? As the binding curve shifts to the right, that indicates increased unloading to the tissues or increased oxygen delivery to the tissues. When the curve is shifted to the left, that shows decreased oxygen delivery to tissues. Right, so that's something I think you just want to write down and kind of burn into your mind when you see these curves. Right, so under what conditions does the blood deliver more oxygen to the tissues? When the curve is shifted to the? When it's shifted to the right. And we see that on these pH curves right here. All right. There is a compound that helps regulate oxygen affinity to hemoglobin, and it's a compound called 2,3-diphosphoglycerate, 2,3-DPG. And that's an intermediate of glycolysis. It's a glycolytic intermediate, so your body produces this stuff all the time. And when there is, for instance, when you're at high altitude, the partial pressure of oxygen decreases, right? And when you go down to sea level, the partial pressure of oxygen increases. Right, so if you start traveling and you go up into the mountains, there's less oxygen available for you to breathe. That means that there's going to be less saturation on hemoglobin. So there's less oxyhemoglobin, which is the form that's bound to oxygen. And oxyhemoglobin inhibits the production of 2,3-DPG. And as oxyhemoglobin goes away or decreases, then there is less inhibition of 2,3-DPG production, which means what? There is increasing levels of 2,3-DPG when that happens. Yeah. Yeah, it adjusts affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin, just the concentration of 2,3-DPG. All right, so if we increase 2,3-DPG, then we lower the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen. When we lower the affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin, the curve is shifted to the right. All right, so what does that mean? When 2,3-DPG is increased and this curve is shifted to the right, what's the effect on the tissues? Then more oxygen is unloaded into the tissues when that happens, right? And then if we see what was the initial response, decreased because of that altitude, decreased delivery of oxygen to tissues, but as 2,3-DPG increases, right, that brings it back to more normal physiologic unloading in the tissues, right? So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? And keyed on 2,3-DPG, which is found in red blood cells, very readily found in red blood cells. When 2,3-DPG increases because of low partial pressures of oxygen, then the oxygen binding curve is shifted to the right, and more oxygen then is just unloaded into the tissues to compensate for this lower partial pressure of oxygen to begin with. Okay, so we got three things. We only talked about two, but we got three things that can affect the affinity of oxygen for hemoglobin. We talked about pH, right? And in particular, for instance, when you start exercising or when blood flow is reduced to a muscle, the pH decreases. And what happens to affinity then? It decreases, the curve is shifted to the right, and we have more unloading of oxygen into the tissues as the pH is decreased. Right? And we call that the Bohr effect. The Bohr effect has to do with how oxygen delivery to tissues is affected by pH. Right? So as pH decreases, more oxygen is delivered to tissues. Right? We talked about 2,3-DPG. As 2,3-DPG increases in concentration, again, the curve is shifted to the right, and that means more oxygen is unloaded from hemoglobin when that happens. Right? But we didn't talk about temperature yet so far, and we're not going to really scrutinize the binding curves of oxygen to hemoglobin with a change in temperature. Right? We're just going to tell you one key thing. As the temperature increases, and when, under what kind of circumstance might your temperature increase? Fever, that's true. But how about if we all just put our pencils down and jogged up the stairs 10 times? Sure, your body temperature is going to increase, right? So under the conditions of exercise, body temperature is going to increase. And what would be a good idea under conditions of exercise? Give more oxygen to your muscles or withdraw oxygen? Probably give them more. And indeed, with increased temperature and holding everything else constant, the binding curve is shifted to the right, which means what? More unloading of oxygen in the tissues, giving them more oxygen, right, giving those mitochondria more oxygen to make ATP under the conditions of exercise, right, as well as fever. Okay, so this is what I want you to know. Shifted to the right, more unloading of oxygen in the tissues. If the binding curve is shifted to the left, that means less oxygen is going to be released into the tissues. Okay, is that the last, oh, it's not the last slide. But here I see a couple red blood cells, a couple different kinds of red blood cells. And the ones on the left are normal. And this looks like a nice scanning electron micrograph right here, because I can actually get a three-dimensional sense of a red blood cell. And you can see that they're circular and they have this big dimple on the inside, which increases the surface area of the plasma membrane, that kind of decreases the volume of this red blood cell. Right, so if you decrease the volume and increase the surface area, that enhances exchange, right? And we want oxygen to come in and out of this thing pretty easily. So that's the importance of this cell shape. But it also has another important reason. Because they're discs, when they float around in the blood, they have a tendency to layer on top of each other, one on top of another. Just like if you were to put a bunch of plates away in the cupboard, how would you put them in? Would you put one in vertical and another this way and another flat and another this way? You would do what? To get them all to fit in, you would just stack them up really nice, right? And red blood cells have the ability to do that when they're flowing. They just kind of stack up, which means what? As the blood is flowing, it can carry more red blood cells, which means it carries more hemoglobin, it carries more oxygen to the tissues when they have this nice shape. And also because they're nice and round like that, they don't get stuck in small blood vessels. They can flow through very small blood vessels very easily because they have nice smooth membranes. Okay, as opposed to the cells that we see over here on the right-hand side that has lost the shape. Here's one with a little dimple, almost looks like a circle, but not quite. But these others have these jagged points on them. Okay, and these cells have been sickled. So these are red blood cells. And this is what blood looks like from a patient that's undergoing sickle cell crisis. And sickle cell is a condition where the beta chains, remember for hemoglobin it has four protein chains, it's got two betas and two alphas, and when there is a point mutation in just one amino acid in the beta chain, then the hemoglobin doesn't arrange itself inside the cell properly. Right, it stacks in a little bit different way, and it deforms the shape of the cell. Just from one little simple mutation, changing one amino acid in a beta chain to another amino acid, it changes it really from a hydrophilic to a hydrophobic amino acid, so it's a fairly major change, right, causes this huge change in function of these cells. Now they don't stack when they go through a blood vessel, and when they go through a small vessel, right, they get stuck. And when they get stuck in a blood vessel, that prevents blood flow to that tissue and can actually kill that tissue. And so we call this sickle cell anemia. And actually, when a cell like this sickles up, then I think really the only way to repair it is actually to lyse it, to get rid of it from somebody's body, which then produces an anemia on top of that. All right, so sickle cell anemia, you can understand the genetic basis of that and something about the primary structure of that one chain of those the beta proteins produces this huge change in these cells, which will basically, over time, kill all the tissues in a patient that has sickle cell anemia, especially the highly metabolic tissues, like brain and kidney, retina, and things of that nature. Okay? But there's, I guess, one other thing that I wanted to point out. We've all experienced a condition where we have decreased oxygen in, say, a muscle. Right? And when is that condition? You've all experienced it. Okay, over-exercise, or maybe you're just sitting, having coffee, or taking notes or something, and then all of a sudden, a muscle goes into spasm, right? It goes into a cramp, okay? And when that muscle goes into that spasm, blood can't get to it, just like when somebody is in sickle cell crisis, blood cells can't get to a tissue, right? They're experiencing that same situation you're feeling. And what are you feeling when that muscle goes into spasm? Are you like walking around showing that off, that nice big muscle right there? What are you doing? You're jumping around, you're breathing funny, you're doing different gyrations in your body. You'll do anything to get rid of that muscle cramp. Because why? Well, it hurts like hell, right? It hurts really, really bad. So somebody in sickle cell crisis is experiencing that same kind of pain, but not just in one muscle, right? It's all over their body. So that's a really, really terrible situation to have. And so how do we treat somebody that's in intractable pain like that? If somebody's experiencing that kind of pain, well, then we give them opiates, right, to deal with that pain. All right, so patients with sickle cell anemia can easily become addicted to opiates, but they might also need opiates regularly to deal with this pain whenever they go into sickle cell crisis. And remember, back when we were talking about Parkinson's disease, and it's easy to mistake somebody with Parkinson's disease because they have a staggered gait, their speech is slurred. It's easy to misidentify somebody with Parkinson's as what? As somebody that is on drugs or intoxicated with alcohol, right? And so somebody with Parkinson's disease sometimes run into people that treat them like a drug seeker. Right, which is really terrible, right? Because that's not the underlying etiology. And the same thing with sickle cell patients, right? It's easy, if somebody's not educated, to treat them as a drug seeker because they need opiates all the time, right? But that's not really the case. How should we treat them? Well, they should be treated with opiates so that they don't experience this terrible pain, right? And they're not somebody that has a chemical dependency. It's just this underlying physiologic condition that we have to help them with. Okay. All right, so that is sickle cell. Again, that just shows you how a small change in structure can produce huge changes in function, right? It's just a change in one amino acid. All right, so let's look at, so we talked about oxygen. How is oxygen transported in the blood again? Bound to hemoglobin, right? And very little is dissolved in plasma, right? So we need that hemoglobin to transport oxygen in our bodies. All right, CO2 is another gas that has to be transported in our bodies, and it's transported in a little bit different way. Carbon dioxide has a much higher solubility in water compared to oxygen, so that when a cell produces carbon dioxide, 10% of that carbon dioxide can dissolve in plasma, but very little oxygen. But CO2 dissolves very nicely, and so plasma can carry 10% of the oxygen around in your body. Some of that carbon dioxide, okay, will enter a red blood cell, and some of it can combine with hemoglobin to form carbaminohemoglobin. Right, that's another 20%. So 30% is transported in these two ways, but that leaves 70% has to be transported in some other mechanism. But we're already familiar with this other mechanism, okay, because when carbon dioxide enters the cell, it can combine with water. As long as there's carbonic anhydrase there, it's converted into carbonic acid. Carbonic acid then breaks down into bicarbonate, right? And bicarbonate has really high solubilities in water, It's almost like sodium chloride or sugar when you put that in your coffee, right? You can just, you can't almost overdo it. Same thing for bicarbonate. So the red blood cell then carries bicarbonate around to the lungs, right? And when it produces bicarbonate, the red blood cell also produces this hydrogen ion, right? And this hydrogen ion, okay, combines with hemoglobin. Right? This bicarbonate right here could leave the cell, and notice that it has, it's an anion. So if that ion, anion leaves the cell, it's going to change the membrane potential. So in order for when bicarbonate leaves the red blood cell not to change the membrane potential, the resting membrane potential of the cell, if an anion leaves, guess what? An anion, another anion, has to enter the cell. And chloride does enter the red blood cell. Right, so now we have bicarbonate that is now dissolved in plasma. 70% of carbon dioxide that our body produces is transported in the blood as the bicarbonate ion. Right, and that helps, of course, has, maintains pH in our body as well. So when chloride enters, as bicarbonate leaves, we call that the chloride shift. Chloride shift. Chloride is imported into the cell because this bicarbonate is leaving the cell. All right, so this is in the tissue spaces where carbon dioxide is being produced. Right, and then where is this blood going to go? It's in a systemic capillary right now. Where is it eventually going to end up? Where's another place where exchange can take place? Yeah, in the pulmonary capillary, right? You got pulmonary and systemic circulations. So here is now blood in the pulmonary circulation. Here is pulmonary artery. We know that's relatively low in oxygen, but not completely devoid of oxygen as we saw in those saturation curves. Right, and then when it picks up oxygen, it's almost 100% saturated. So that's what I see right here, the blue versus the red color. Right, that's not too terribly important because what are we talking about? We're talking about CO2. All right, so now we're in a pulmonary capillary, and a capillary, of course, is specialized for exchange. It only has an endothelium, and the wall of the alveolus is also just a simple squamous epithelium. So carbon dioxide dissolved in plasma will move down its concentration gradient from relatively high in blood to almost zero in the air in this alveolus. So that's a pretty big concentration gradient for diffusion. And when that happens, there's going to be a new equilibrium established between carbon dioxide that's in the plasma because it's now starting to leave and carbon dioxide that's inside the cell. Carbon dioxide that's bound to hemoglobin. This carbon dioxide will dissociate from carbamamino hemoglobin and then it can diffuse out of the plasma. And again, that's just the Le Chatelier's principle. And how else is carbon dioxide transported? Not only as dissolved in plasma and carbamamino hemoglobin, but also as bicarbonate in the plasma. All right, so as the CO2 leaves a red blood cell, which way is it going to shift this carbonic anhydrase reaction? It's going to shift it to the left, right? The carbonic anhydrase reaction is going to try to replenish this CO2 that a person is breathing out of their body. So how can a red blood cell do that? Well, it can kick out a chloride and import a bicarbonate anion, and because of carbonic anhydrase, that bicarbonate and this hydrogen ion will form carbonic acid, which then will break down into CO2 and water, and then this CO2 then is, by diffusion, enters the alveolus, and then you just breathe that out of your body. All right, so most of the carbon dioxide transported in the blood is in the form of bicarbonate right here, and that bicarbonate is dissolved in plasma. All right, but that comes from the red blood cell because the red blood cell has an enzyme that can interconvert these different substrates right here. What's the name of that enzyme? Carbonic anhydrase. Yeah, carbonic anhydrase. Okay. So that's it for respiratory chapter. Unless you have some questions. So these binding curves look a little intimidating, but basically what do you have to know? If it's shifted to the right, it does what? It delivers more oxygen to the tissues, right? And physiologically it makes sense. Increase in temperature or decrease in pH shifts the curve to the right. Okay. That ends that show. Okay, urinary system. Okay, I probably won't be able to talk about everything that you have slides on in the urinary system, and for sure, I'm not going to go over the anatomy of the urinary system, because I think last time, and I don't think so, I'm sure I mentioned, what, for today's lecture and also on Tuesday, that you just have to make sure that you understand your anatomy of the nephron and the kidney that you learned in anatomy, because that's just a prerequisite for understanding this. All right, so what is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? It is the nephron. Yeah, it is the nephron, right? Like the what's the structural and functional unit of life? It's a cell. Structural and functional unit of contraction is sarcomere, and structural and functional unit of communication between cells is the synapse, right? So if you know all the little pieces of all those elements, put them all together, then you have a pretty good idea of what that really complicated thing is, right? All right, so the structural and functional unit for urine formation is the nephron. So we're going to look at some of its components, and when we understand all of its components, then we're going to have a pretty good idea of how urine is produced and why urine is produced. Okay, so just to kind of quiz everybody, just so I get an understanding of where we are in the class, when we think of a nephron, okay, we can break it down into some major categories. Okay, structural categories, major structural categories. Can anybody remember how many structural categories there are? If you're going to take everything in a nephron and break it down into some major categories, how would we break those structures down? How many categories would there be? There's going to be two. That's really good. Now we have to know what we call those things. What do we call those two things that make up a nephron? The two categories. There are tubes that contain filtrate or urine, and we call those tubular elements. And then there are tubes that contain blood, right? So, and those are what? Those are blood vessels, right? And so we call those the vascular elements. So a nephron has those two main components, either a tubular element or a vascular element, and they interact throughout the length of that nephron to produce urine. Okay. See me during office hours, if that's not making a whole lot of sense to you. But you kind of have to know that before you can appreciate these lectures. Okay, so in the process of urine formations, the kidneys regulate the volume of blood plasma. And when you regulate blood volume, what else are you regulating in your body because of that intrinsic mechanism of the heart? Blood pressure, that's right. As the heart stretches, it gets stronger. Increased blood volume stretches the heart under most circumstances. If it's a normal heart, right, that will increase blood pressure. The kidney also gets rid of waste products in plasma. It helps adjust the concentration of electrolytes like sodium and potassium, bicarbonate and others. And remember, when you regulate bicarbonate, you're regulating the pH. Or, well, here it is right here, plasma pH, pH of your body. Okay, and not only these things, but it helps maintain blood glucose levels. Okay, because the kidney would waste a lot of glucose if not for a particular kind of special system. All right, so here's some gross anatomy. All right, I don't think I'm going to go over any of this kind of stuff that you should know. Oh, but here's a question. What is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? Oh, you know that one already. Okay, that is the nephron. Okay, so here we have a nephron, and you have about a million nephrons per kidney. You got two kidneys, and urine formation. So here is the tubular elements of a nephron, starting with Bowman's capsule or the glomerular capsule. And there's a process that happens right here because there's a capillary inside Bowman's capsule called the glomerulus. Glomerulus is a fairly leaky capillary, so a lot of fluid leaks out of the blood, including all solutes, right? And filtration works by just the size of the molecule. So all water molecules can pass through that capillary, and small solutes, typically large proteins don't because they're too big, and maybe for some other reasons. And of course cells can't because they're way too big, right? To leak out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. And so that process is what we call filtration. And what is the product of a process of filtration? What's left over? Filtrate. Yeah, just like how you made coffee this morning, right? It's based on the size of particles and that suspension of stuff that you had, whether tea, coffee, or whatever. All right, so now we have filtrate in Bowman's capsule. It moves through the rest of these tubular elements. So the first process in urine formation is, you could put a number one right here, that's filtration. That's the first process. And as it's traveling through, right, the proximal convoluted tubule, the loop of Henle, the distal convoluted tubule, and even a little bit of this collecting duct right here, there are two other processes that are working. One process is it can take material from the filtrate, which is in this tubular element, and put it back in the blood vessel. Right, so there's a peritubular capillary surrounding this, all of these tubes right here, and that's what we call reabsorption. When material moves from filtrate back into the blood, we'll see how important that is in just a little bit. All right, but there's another process, the third one and last one, so it's not really too complicated. There are also mechanisms that can take substances that are in the blood, that means they did not get filtered in this first step over here, but they remain in the blood. So there are processes that can take harmful things, for instance, like urea, which is a breakdown product of amino acids. It's a nitrogenous compound that's very toxic, and it can take urea from the blood and put it into a tubule, okay, and that's what we call tubular secretion. And if tubular secretion puts urea in the filtrate, for instance, in this distal convoluted tubule, where is it going to end up? Yeah, it's going to leave your body, right, because it's part of the filtrate, and then filtrate, after all those three steps of processing, when it gets to the collecting duct, it's called urine, and then you just eliminate it from your body. So these are the three basic processes, and we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these things. Renal blood vessels. So here are the vascular elements. All right. Oh, here is a list of tubular elements. I think I put this slide together for you. All right, tubular elements, and the second slide should be vascular elements. Oh, that's nice. I didn't realize I had this in there. Okay. The usual circulation is that you have a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart, and what do we call such a vessel? Takes blood away from the heart. We call that an artery, and that artery turns into an arteriole, which feeds a special kind of vessel that's specialized for exchange, which is a capillary, right? And then that blood flows into a venule, and then where does it go for the usual kind of circulatory system? It goes into a vein, which carries it back to the heart, right? So that's the usual circulation. Just has one capillary bed, an arteriole, which feeds blood to a capillary, and then a venule takes blood away from a capillary, takes it back to the heart. Okay. Nephron is a little bit different. We talked about some of these circulations before, and so it's noteworthy to realize this. There is a portal system in a nephron, which means that there is not one capillary bed, but there are two capillary beds back to back. And remember, what's the job of an arteriole is to bring blood to a capillary. The glomerulus is a capillary. It's a fenestrated capillary, which means it's leaky, right? Then blood flows into the efferent arteriole. And what's the job of an arteriole? It brings blood to a capillary, right? And in this particular case, the peritubular capillaries that surround all the tubular elements of the nephron. So this efferent arteriole is acting like a portal vessel, just like the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. And I think maybe we talked about another one. I can't remember. But anyway, here is at least a second one. All right, it's very rare, so you should probably have an idea of where some of these rare structures are. There's one in the nephron. So I for sure would, if I were you, I would be able to draw this out. Okay, make sure you can separate the vascular elements from the tubular elements, and be able to name all of these different things. Okay, because we're going to be talking about these. Okay, the renal corpuscle, I see right here, the renal corpuscle is part tubular element and part vascular element put together. The vascular element is the glomerulus, and it is inside the tubular element that we call Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule. If we put these two things together, we get the renal corpuscle. And this is where that first process takes place, namely filtration, glomerular filtration. Let's see. Yes, this is where I want to start talking about. So here we have that renal corpuscle. And here we have the glomerular capsule, or sometimes we call this Bowman's capsule. Okay. And Bowman's capsule has two divisions to it, just like a serous membrane. Okay. Anybody remember the two divisions of a serous membrane? serous membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world as opposed to a mucous membrane. There's a visceral division of a serous membrane right on the visceral organ, maybe like the heart or lungs or something, and it's continuous with the membrane that is lining the cavity, right? Maybe the pleural cavity, which would be the wall of the thorax. And then there's a little space between the parietal and visceral serous membranes that contains fluid, serous fluid. Well, I want you to use that same model to understand this renal corpuscle. Here is the outer wall of Bowman's capsule. This would be analogous to the parietal layer of a serous membrane. So we could actually call this the parietal division of the glomerular capsule or the renal corpuscle. And it comes over here and meets up with the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole, and it continues on and covers all the capillaries of the glomerulus. Right? It's the same membrane, but it's in a different location. So this right here, these cells are what we call, make up the visceral division of the glomerular capsule. Right? So here's the parietal division, here's the visceral. And the parietal division is really not too interesting because it's just a good barrier. It doesn't allow for exchange, right? It just collects filtrate. That's its major job. But the visceral division is really special. It's made of these, what we call podocytes, because it has these long processes sticking out of it that reminded somebody of feet, right? And it's highly convoluted, and there's a big space between these convolutions, between the these foot processes on neighboring podocytes, and we call these filtration slits. So all solute molecules and water can pass through these filtration slits very, very easily. And even the wall of the capillary is fenestrated, so it has all of these fenestrations or windows, big holes in the wall of the capillary. So that just enhances exchange from blood into filtrate, right? So it really acts like a coffee filter. Big things get stuck in the glomerulus. All little things get pushed out because of the pressure is high, blood pressure is high inside the vascular element, and is very close to zero in Bowman's capsule. So just by the pressure differences, things move from plasma into the filtrate right here. Okay, so filtration takes place because of the structure of this filtration membrane within the renal corpuscle. All right, so now we have, so that's the first process. So now we have filtrate in Bowman's capsule, and it's going to move into the next tubular element of the nephron, which is what? What's the next tubular element? I want to show you this, but I don't really want to show you for too long because it's labeled. I don't want you just to read the label. What's the tube that's connected up to Bowman's capsule? Let's see, where is it? I wanted you to memorize this. What's the tube connected to Bowman's capsule? And it's not labeled. It should be labeled on here. This is, the proximal convoluted tubule. You see it labeled anywhere?
Yeah.
It's where someplace? Over here someplace? Okay, good. I believe you. Oh, yeah, proximal convoluted tubule. Good. All right, so let's go back to this slide that we were just looking at. Okay, so here's a tube that's connected to Bowman's capsule. What's the name of that tube right there? That's the proximal convoluted tubule, right? And we had nice models in lab. Forget that it was labeled right there. Okay, so we said plasma proteins are mostly excluded because they're too big. And most proteins have a negative charge, and the filtration slits have a negative charge. And what can you tell me about like charges? They repel each other, right? So these proteins are kind of repelled from the filtration slits, so they don't get filtered. And some of these proteins are just way too big to get through those pores anyway. Some albumin does leave, but then it is actively put back into the blood in that proximal convoluted tubule. So there's an active mechanism. It's called receptor-mediated endocytosis. Right, so that's in a normal nephron. If a nephron is damaged to where the filtration slits are very large and the fenestrations are really, really large, okay, then protein can leave the plasma very easily and end up in filtrate, and there can be so much that it won't be reabsorbed and put back into the blood. And in that case, it's going to end up in urine, and we call that proteinuria when that happens. So that's a sign of a diseased nephron, okay? Maybe it might be just simple nephritis, or it might be something else that's happening there. Here's a nice scanning electron microscope micrograph of these podocytes that surround a glomerulus. Here's a Here's just another nice electron micrograph. Okay, so I don't want to belabor those micrographs, but they're nice to look at. Okay, so here we have a nice illustration of Bowman's capsule. And here's the glomerulus. And here we see these proteins in like a green entering. Right, so here's the afferent arteriole. And what do we have? Very few proteins in Bowman's capsule. Most of them leave the corpuscle. They're still contained in blood. But all of these little blue particles right here could be water molecules or sugar molecules, sodium, potassium, hydrogen ions. All small molecules can pass through the fenestrations and filtration slits and end up in the filtrate. Okay. And what's the name of that process? Where stuff enters Bowman's capsule from plasma. That's filtration. Okay. The glomerular filtration rate is just the amount of filtrate produced by both kidneys, right, per minute. And it averages about 115 mLs per minute in women, 125 mLs per minute in men. Now, what kind of volume does that strike you as? Large volume or like a small microscopic volume? That's a huge volume, right? 100 ml flask, you know, is about this tall. So if we add that up for a period of a day, because there's a lot of minutes in a day, that's 45 gallons get filtered by your kidneys every single day. That's a huge job that they're doing. All right, so there's a lot of water that gets lost in Bowman's capsule, ends up in the rest of the tubular elements of the nephron. Right, and if we were to lose 45 gallons of water every single day from our body, at that rate, how long could you live? I don't know, I think I did a calculation one time. I think we would dehydrate in about 3 minutes. All right, so that's a really good way of getting rid of things we don't want from our body, but it's a terrible way if we want to keep those things in that filtrate in our body, for instance, like water. All right, so most of the filtered water must be resorbed or you would dehydrate very, very rapidly, right? 45 gallons a day. Well, you couldn't even drink 45 gallons a day if you had to replace that by just drinking. All right, so that process, I want to talk about that just a little bit before some of these other things. Right, that process is called reabsorption of salt and water. Right, so that was the second process that we talked about, and that's a process of taking material from the filtrate and putting it back into the blood. And that mostly happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. Right, it returns most molecules and water from filtrate back to the peritubular capillaries, because it's the peritubular capillaries that surround the proximal convoluted tubule. So we said, about 180 liters of filtrate are produced every day, but only 1 to 2 liters of urine are excreted in 24 hours. And that's probably even on the high side. All right, so that means that 178 liters have to be resorbed in the kidney, put back into the blood. Okay, and it's mostly the job of the proximal convoluted tubule to do that. All right, but your kidney does, I think I mentioned, does have to produce urine all day long, right? Or otherwise the kidney is dead or going to die. All right, so a kidney has to produce at least a minimum 400 mLs of urine every day. We call that the obligatory water loss. And if your body can't give up that 400 mLs per day, then that's a huge metabolic crisis for that person. Okay. All right, so now I think I want to flip back to GFR. Okay. So GFR is just a glomerular filtration rate. So that is just the amount of filtrate that's produced every day by your body, and it's regulated by a couple of different mechanisms. It's controlled by extrinsic and intrinsic mechanisms. So when we say extrinsic, I don't know, what does that mean? What does an extrinsic mechanism sort of mean to you? Yeah, outside the kidney, maybe it's a response loop, reflex loop that's going to require some neurons to do that. And of course, it's not going to be a somatic nervous system, it's going to be autonomic nervous system, right? And intrinsic has to do with just some properties of the kidney itself, the tubules themselves. And vasoconstriction or vasodilation of that afferent arteriole affects the rate of blood flow into the glomerulus, and thus the glomerular filtration rate. So if the afferent arteriole vasoconstricts, what happens to flow through the glomerulus? Yes, it's going to slow down. Okay, but what if we vasodilate an afferent arteriole? It's going to increase flow through that glomerulus. Okay, now let's do this. Let's increase the diameter of the afferent arteriole while vasoconstricting the efferent arteriole. What's going to happen? Okay, so it's going to the efferent vasoconstriction will reduce flow a little bit, but that will increase the pressure inside the glomerulus. And when you have increased pressure in the plasma inside the glomerulus and still almost zero in the filtrate in Bowman's capsule, then that will increase the glomerular filtration rate because now we have a much bigger pressure difference, right? So that nephron is pretty tricky in all the ways that it can adjust glomerular filtration rate by vasoconstriction or dilation of both the afferent and efferent arterioles. So let's maybe try to see how this might happen. All right, sympathetic activity constricts the afferent arteriole. Right, so if we have a decreased blood pressure, right, there are baroreceptors in the carotid sinus and aortic arch, right, will send signals to the vasomotor center, and the vasomotor center is going to say, oh, your blood pressure is dropping. Right. What is one way to counteract that? What's a decision that the vasomotor center is going to do? It's going to say, well, we don't need a lot of parasympathetic activity. We need to cut that back and increase sympathetic tone in the body. And if we increase sympathetic tone, what happens to cardiac output? It increases. Stroke volume and heart rate increase. Okay. And it's going to cause vasoconstriction in the skin. Right, and also vasoconstriction in the arterioles of these kidneys. But let's talk about vasoconstriction in the skin. What's that going to do? What's a good way to think of that? Here we said stroke volume and heart rate increase, but what about over here? What parameter are we really thinking about? We're talking about resistance, right? Total peripheral resistance. If we vasoconstrict, we increase total peripheral resistance, and what effect will that have on blood pressure? Oh, here's total peripheral resistance, sure. Okay, that's going to increase blood pressure, just like increasing cardiac output will. Okay, but here, since we vasoconstricted the arterioles, that's going to decrease the glomerular filtration rate, that's going to decrease urine production, that's going to increase blood volume, which is going to act synergistically with these other effects produced by the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so if that increases blood volume, that increases blood pressure as well. So increased cardiac output subtracts from the initial stimulus, increasing total peripheral resistance, subtracts from the initial stimulus, right? And increased blood volume also subtracts from that initial stimulus. Because remember, blood pressure is equal to what? This is totally not intuitive, but we derived that equation. Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate, which is cardiac output, times total peripheral resistance. Right, so if you just sort of have that equation burned in your memory, then this flow diagram makes a whole lot of sense. Okay, so that would be the extrinsic mechanism carried out by the sympathetic nervous system. And now your only thing left to do in class today is to sign the sign-in sheet. Okay, because we're going to talk about autoregulation intrinsic property for regulating GFR. And the slides that I would like for you to make sure that you have next time are not in your book, but they're in your slides. I want you to look at this one, okay? And I want you to look at this one right here. These are exam figures. And so we're going to talk about these extensively on Tuesday, okay? Because on these two slides, you're going to like recapitulate everything that you learned in the class. All the physical chemistry, all your anatomy, and all that good stuff. No pressure. I've got 1770. 1770 and 1748. 1748 and 1770. They're in the study guide. Hopefully I put them in the PowerPoint presentation, but I'm not exactly sure. Yeah.
We should try the people for chapter 20.
That's a profile of the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle for 28 days and how the profiles of the hormones change, like FSH, LH, estrogen, and progesterone, which was the extra credit quiz, that exact same figure. And I think maybe on that email I mentioned what figure number that was, this one right here.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Dr. Bellis, for that letter of reference for it all, you'll have it ready for next Thursday? For your event.
What? No, you know, I want to wait until I know your grade in here.
Okay,
it would make it a much better reference if I could.
Okay. And okay. If I needed another reference for another school, could I